Hello, this is Leslie Garfotenzer, and this is Legal Tenzer, casual conversations on noteworthy legal topics. Lately, issues of corporate governance have been forefront in the news. The downfall of FTX, the cryptocurrency corporation, and the sale of Twitter to Elon Musk can be traced in some part to failures in the governance of these corporate entities. Today, I'm speaking with Darren Rosenblum, professor of law and associate dean of graduate studies at McGill University, who explains what we mean by corporate governance and explores the issues surrounding these high-profile firms. I've learned a lot, and I'm sure you will too. Thank you so much for joining me. It's good to see you, hear you, I should say. Corporate governance has been in the news a lot. It's been in the news when we're talking about FTX, and it's been in the news, I guess, because Twitter was run by a board, and even probably some of these bank mergers or bank failures, I might add. But first, let's talk about what is corporate governance? What do we mean when we say corporate governance?
Well, so we all know what governance is, and we typically think of government, meaning public institutions that are part of the state, right?
Right.
So we go to the polls and elect representatives and the president and the Senate and judges in certain jurisdictions. Corporate governance is a different thing, but it's similar. It's about the system by which the organization operates. So just like when we go to the polls and vote for a leader, we are helping construct the leadership of the government entity. Corporate governance is really about the architecture of how firms operate and how they divide power. And power is divided in a very different way from how it's divided in a state. So in a state, we go to the polls and we all have a stake because we're citizens and we're entitled to a vote. Within a corporation, particularly a public corporation, the firm issues shares, which are the equivalent of a percentage of the total value of the firm. And so this creates the overall market capitalization of a firm. In most publicly traded companies, those shares come with a vote.
So if I have shares in Twitter, I could vote for who I want on the board?
So Twitter's a peculiar example because now Twitter is a private company.
Right.
It's privately owned by Elon Musk, right?
Right.
But prior to that, it was a publicly traded firm. And yes, the shareholders would have a vote.
So there's a big, you ever see The Office? There's like a big, one of the big office scenes is where the shareholders are all in front of the board. But anyway, I'm just thinking of that. Okay.
So there are stories like that and scenes like that. But the way it really works is that the shareholders elect the board.
Right.
Right. And the board of directors is the central legal body of the firm. They're responsible for strategy and oversight of the firm, right? And their main job is to pick the CEO, the chief executive officer, who basically runs the day-to-day operation of the firm. So you really have three parties. Like in government, you have a tripartite branch, right? Mm-hmm. Where you have the executive, the legislature and the judiciary,
right.
And the people play a role in this by electing the executive and the legislature, and in some jurisdictions, the judiciary, right? In the corporate context, it's the shareholders, the board, and the executive. The day-to-day operation of the firm is basically all flows from the authority that is given by the board to the executive, and then in turn, the executive hires all the upper level managers who oversee the entirety of the firm. So when you have a large bank with hundreds of thousands of employees, like say Citibank, mm-hmm. right? The way it works is the shareholders elect the board. The board picks the CEO. The CEO picks his team. In that case, it's a her, but that's exceptional because only whatever 8 or 9% of CEOs are women, and the numbers are even lower in the financial sector. And then in turn, that person is in charge of the whole firm.
So I have a quick question. Does every publicly traded company have to have a board? Is that like a required rule that, you know, and private companies don't have to have a board, right? That's why they're, you know, family run businesses. If they're truly family run, they don't have to have a board, right? Or am I wrong?
Well, they have board. It depends on the state in which they're incorporated, right? The firm gets its power to be an entity thanks to the state, right?
Because, I mean, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So actually that makes sense, right? If I want to start a corporation, I have to be incorporated by the state.
Right. You have to file the papers in a state, whether it's New York or Delaware or wherever. Mm-hmm. And it's because you file those papers and follow the rules of the statute within those jurisdictions that you can actually benefit from limited liability. Mm-hmm. You have a corporation and you don't follow any of the rules, meaning, you know, in many cases, keeping the books clean, so separating corporate funds from personal funds, treating the firm as a separate entity, following records rules, filing rules, et cetera. If you don't follow those rules, then the state could choose to not respect the corporate entity. And that's when, for example, when there's a tort, if the firm doesn't have enough assets, sometimes the court will order the piercing of the corporate veil and hold the owner of the corporation liable for the corporation's debts. Mm-hmm. So it really is the thing that, like a family, the state is responsible for recognizing the legitimacy of the firm. Hmm. Now, you can form a family without getting married and without having the state, and it plays a background role. Within the corporate context, that's not the case. It has to go through the state. Hmm. So the state sets the rules. And so the long answer to your question, which was whether you have to have a board, is it depends on a state. But yes, for publicly traded companies, there is a requirement of a board. But the thing is, sort of the second piece of your question is, what about family companies? And with family companies, often there is a board and it's just the members of the family.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. So, and you can even find examples of that in very large companies that are family dominated, in which members of the board are members of the family. So for example, on the Walmart board, right, you have several members of the family.
What about Sackler? That, you know, right?
Of course, Sackler's a good example as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, intermingling between a family and a corporation is an interesting and complicated separate topic. It doesn't change the rules that apply to the firm. Regardless of who the owner is, the state in which the firm files for incorporation is the one that governs, that dictates what rules the firm has to follow.
All right. So I have a question. It's a little off topic, but I'm sure it's probably about piercing the corporate veil. I'm embarrassed. I don't know it, but I'll ask it. Let's say that I want to run a business. I want to run a lawn mowing business. Mm. And I want to run it under the radar. I don't want to pay taxes, whatever, right? I don't want to incorporate with the state, I should say. What is the downside of owning a corporation or a business? You can't call it a corporation, right? What's the downside of owning a business and not registering it with the state?
Well, it's that you have personal liability for the corporation's actions.
Okay, I see. Got it. Okay,
right? Yep, so yep, that yep. If the lawnmower, let's imagine, you know, staying with your hypo, that you have an, you know, that they invent like a Roomba lawnmower, which I'm sure they have somewhere, and it causes damage by running over a person, right? You individually are liable for that damage.
Got it.
So the incentive to have a corporation is huge because it protects you as an individual from liability incurred by the business.
Okay, perfect. That makes perfect sense. All right. So now we have our corporation, we have a corporate board, right? And so
except there are firms, and I think, you know, the recent case of FTX with Sam Bankman-Fried is a great example where they don't really follow the rules. And it ends up biting them in basically undermining the functioning of the firm.
But were they incorporated? I mean, they were a corporation, FTX,
yes.
Right? Okay. So what happened? So explain what happened and explain why it was undermined.
Well, what happened is basically Sam Bankman-Fried established this firm, like with many unicorns, which are billion-dollar plus firms that are not publicly traded. It was founded and dominated by this one person, often that's a man. Here it was Sam Bankman-Fried. Mm-hmm. And he basically ran the firm entirely on his own without much input whatsoever. He had a couple of other people in his close-knit circle that played some role, but despite repeatedly getting suggestions and advice from lawyers to have a proper board structure, he refused. And it really led to everything that happened because the whole function of a board is to provide oversight. So when an executive is making key strategic mistakes, such as overextending loans, engaging in transactions with assets that are too risky, like cryptocurrency, right? We have a situation in which the board has a responsibility to make sure that the firm is operating legally and to make sure that it's operating in the interests of the shareholders.
FTX was not publicly traded. So he had this huge control over what happened. And I guess the thing is that if it's privately held, you can pick your own board and your own board has an incentive, even more of an incentive, to indulge the leader, because if they don't indulge the leader, they can lose their place on the board, right?
Right. And these board positions are often paid. And that's really what happens when we talk about capture, right? Which is a law and economics concept in which an institution is controlled by some other entity, right? So when the board is captured by the executive, we often refer to it as an imperial CEO, because the CEO runs the firm like an empire, really, dictating key decision-making. So there are publicly traded firms in which the executive does dominate the board, but it's, of course, much easier to achieve when it's a privately held firm. So let's look, for example, at today's Twitter, which is now a privately held firm, and Elon Musk can basically do with the firm as he sees fit.
Because he doesn't have shareholders who are the checks and balances for him.
Correct.
He can't be unelected, much like your election analogy, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So part of what happened in FTX is that the whole controversy underscores the purpose of corporate governance, which is to protect investors, customers, and other parties from malfeasance. And so when you do business with a firm and you see that it doesn't have proper corporate governance, certainly one should be suspicious. So there were investors who had enormous sums of money tied up in the crypto exchange that FTX ran, and they lost their money, right? So the notion that, which I think was, you know, stupidly widely spread a year or two ago, was that this was an asset like any other asset, or somewhat similar to other assets, maybe a little riskier, was false, right? Because when you're dealing with an asset issued by a bank like Goldman Sachs, we know Goldman Sachs has a board. It's a properly operated firm with intensely complicated governance structures that generally comply with public rules as to how the firm should operate. What was going on with FTX was really shielded from that whole set of rules that functions as an overlay to protect parties that interact with the firm. The problem, of course, is that investors don't necessarily know this.
Right.
And one thing that's particularly unfortunate about the whole collapse of FTX and of a lot of cryptocurrency is a lot of investors in cryptocurrency were people of color. Disproportionately, people of color were invested in cryptocurrency. And I'm pretty sure some people are working on this. I'm not working on it myself. But what it does underscore is the ways in which a lack of regulation in a particular investment space can be very problematic. So allowing cryptocurrency trading without oversight, which is basically what has been happening in the past few years, was in fact, I think, a dangerous choice. And now with the collapse of FTX and recent actions by the CFTC, you know, the commodities governance body, we're seeing a much more careful and robust attention being paid to having some rules that govern these assets.
Wow, it's so interesting. It's enlightening. Tell us just a little bit about Twitter, because the Twitter board, you know, when the sale was going on, we kept hearing about the Twitter board accepted this and rejected that. So what about Twitter?
Well, the takeaway from Twitter, and I really would suggest your listeners check out Professor Eric Talley and Professor Ann Lipton. Those are professors at Columbia and Tulane, respectively, who each provided pretty intensive commentary on this controversy as it was happening.
I don't mean to interrupt, but Professor Lipton actually was on this podcast.
Oh, very good. Well, she's amazing.
Talk about Elon Musk. Yes. We talk more about the sale itself than the actual corporate governance aspect of it.
And she's doing some very interesting follow-up scholarship on the import of the whole Twitter controversy for corporate governance. So I would encourage you and your listeners to sort of follow that space as well. But I think, you know, there are a couple of key takeaways from the whole Twitter controversy. The most essential one is that the rule of law held. Essentially, you had, and this is particularly relevant to you as a contracts professor, right? What's particularly compelling, and I know that, you know, you and I have discussed, for example, cases in which there's a typo in the contract and it costs one party $70 million. Yep. Remember, there was that real estate deal where they had the wrong year.
Yeah.
A few years back, right? So we know, as people who teach contracts, how important contracts are, that contracts really are a private form of law that binds the parties themselves, right?
Yeah.
And essentially what we had with the Twitter bid by Musk was that he made a bid and it seemed like it was an impulsive choice on his part, both because the price was high, but also because he didn't do a lot of due diligence before coming up with that number. And the fact that the number was sort of a joke reference to marijuana with the 420 number only reinforces the lack of deliberation in coming up with that offer. But the fact is that while he could decide that on a whim, the lawyers who followed up on what he did made it a binding offer, right? And so then it's an official offer that's before the Twitter board. And while probably nobody on the board at Twitter actually wanted to sell the company to Elon Musk, they basically had no choice because it was such a good offer financially that it would be a dereliction of their duty to the Twitter shareholders to not accept the offer. So essentially, because corporate governance, certainly in the US, but really in a lot of jurisdictions, empowers or centers shareholder rights, the Twitter board was essentially bound to accept the offer. They did accept the offer, and then he tried to weasel out of it, much like our former president would do with 1,000 other contracts, right?
Right.
The lawyer your way out of things is a tried and true technique for some kinds of business people to avoid their contractual engagements. But the law held because this took place in Delaware. And the Delaware Chancery Court, Chancellor McCormick in particular, who was overseeing this, is no fool, and basically held Musk to his word while there was litigation initially between the parties for him to squeak out of the deal. In subtle ways, the court made it very clear to Twitter that this would not be an easy feat. And my guess is that at some point, the lawyers that Musk hired got through to him and made it clear to him that he could not escape this contractual commitment. So to me, the big takeaway from that whole story is that law matters, that corporate law matters, and that contract law matters. The second takeaway implicitly is about the value of corporate governance, just as it is with the FTX case. It's that the deal went through because the Twitter board had to take into account its shareholders. Mm-hmm. And now that Twitter is privately held, we can see in some ways that the governance of the firm is already weaker because the firm has been making impetuous, ill-advised decisions ever since the firm went private. Right. They're controversial choices, but nobody can do anything about them because it's a privately held firm. And just like when you own a car and you have the right to crash your car, mm-hmm. Musk owns Twitter and it's his choice whether he wants to crash the firm.
Huh. I mean, it's so interesting and it makes so much sense. And I guess I see too, kind of from a broader perspective, is the benefits and the curses of going public. I mean, the benefit of going public is Absolutely. You raise a lot more capital, but then you're kind of more, the governance has an additional layer of obligation to it. You know, this all makes sense. I think that you really clarify for me the understanding of why the board, you know, it, I guess they're kind of almost in opposites in that Musk got Twitter because the board was being responsible. FTX crashed because he didn't have the kind of accountability, whereas the board did in Twitter. So this has been really interesting and enlightening, and I really appreciate you taking the time explaining it. Thanks so much.
Oh, sure. Okay. I have to say, I really enjoy talking about corporate law with people who don't know how corporate law works, because it's one of these things, it's a little bit like contracts in this way, that people come to both topics feeling often a little bit intimidated by the power of the law and the sometimes technical nature of the law. But when you actually get into the weeds of it, into the trees of corporate law, like with contracts, it's both quite compelling and actually not that complicated.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, and I said that to my students about everything. Like, if you just take a step back and think about it, it makes sense. Well, you have revived my understanding many, many, many years old on this. So thanks again. It's great to see you. And I really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So there you have it. Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you have a topic you'd like us to discuss, or a professor or attorney with whom you'd like me to speak, send us an email at legaltenzer@westacademic.com and send us any suggestions you may have. We love getting feedback. Have a great day.